Morning, Joe. This feels a bit more normal seeing you on the screen.
It's true. I did see you live and in person, didn't I, over the weekend, which was lovely to take a trip north, I guess, from my house, kind of north and east, to see you in the kind of the expanses of Gippsland.
Yeah, mate, it was lovely to have you up here and get around the tracks and see what had come down over the last couple of weeks and get stuck in. It was good. Look at us, yeah. Top button's nearly done up. It's we're into the week.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's certainly back with a bang for sure. So it's busy times.
Yeah, the year's kicked off for sure, and we've got another hot day down north. Here I am rambling on about the weather, but hey, it's here.
We did say absolutely no more weather chat, but I think we can make an exception for this because obviously it's a catastrophic fire day in here in Victoria, and I thought it might be actually good to probably just explain what that actually means and also talk about a little bit of the context, particularly in relation to your family's joint up north, kind of north of Ballarat.
Yeah, that's it. So the family heirloom, where family from Ireland came out and for the goldfields back in 1850s, 1860s, they landed there and built a mud brick shack that's now fallen down, and we've camped there ever since. But it's in the catastrophic zone, and catastrophic means, you know, just be shit scared, really. No, it just means you've got to have a fire plan. The whole idea and the reason why they did that was off the back of fires back in 2012, where people got caught super unawares, but the fire risk was really dangerous. And then this was sort of the lessons out of Royal Commission into that, and that was like, everyone enact your fire plan today. So if you're staying, stay. If you're not, go. Now, so you don't get caught in the roads, because that's often the most dangerous spot to be on a fire when you panic or any disaster, is being on the roads, because you can get hemmed in.
Yeah, trees falling down. One thing's already in motion, you put another thing in motion, and bad things happen.
Yeah, that's it. So there's fires out there at the moment, folks are up there, and the whole community's, you know, getting around it and trying to do their best and be as best prepared as they can. Best of luck to everyone out there. Absolutely. I know they've been throughout it for, I think it's been going for nearly 2 weeks now. So I feel like if they survive this relatively unscathed, I think there's about 200 hectares that are probably already nearly burnt now. So it's definitely already, you know, put a bit up in the atmosphere. We'll add to that in the winter, but
I guess we could see it out your way. Hey, like you could see it actually. You could see the haze. You could see the haze in Gippsland in the sunset. So you could see the smoke haze for sure.
Yeah, felt like a proper summer evening when that happens. Sort of beautiful, but also eerie. And then you can see the fire piles over here for the pagans, whatever they're going to burn, because all the trees that have fallen
that was
down.
The biggest fire pile I've ever seen in my entire life was driving the back of this little town called Fish Creek. That was honestly the biggest burn pile I've ever seen in my entire life. Like it's, that felt ritualistic. It felt like someone had built a pine tree pyramid, like ready. I don't know what they're putting up on there, but it better be sacred. That's all I can say.
Mate, we drove past that and, we thought, is Fish Creek going to survive that fire or is he going to put it on the map?
Yeah. Sure. You're cooking some salmon the hard way, I guess, yeah.
They'll be cooking something. But, that's what's happening down south in the little island of Australia. Globally, everyone's feeling the heat, I think, whether it's, weather or otherwise, or the freeze, depending on sort of your coordinates at the moment. But I think it's translating a little bit to just a genuine lived experience of what's going on around town.
Definitely. Yeah.
But you're on the hot minute, so let's put you ablaze and
light a fire under my seat to kick off. So my hot take for this week is all around the need for a universal basic income. So in a world where we're getting more and more, I think, contraction of labor and the need for it, so whether that's through automation coming through AI, whether that's through, I think the jobs of the future are much more based in kind of actually sense making rather than kind of necessarily doing. Plus the decline, I think, in the ability for us to actually service from government, our communities, etc. Putting in place a universal basic income would allow us to, rather than freeing up people to have a meaningless 3-day work week, maybe it's about that they can actually kind of find ways to invest themselves back in the places that they call home or the communities that they inhabit.
Mm. Yeah, the shout out for the universal income. It's an interesting one to. Well, it's not interesting. It's a poignant one to bring up at the moment, where everyone's sitting with the turbulence of AI and the transition of a new dawn of an era of what work means and what work is.
Do you buy that AI is real? Like, do you buy that it's actually like it's a new operating system for the world? Like, do you buy that logic, or do you sit there and just be like, oh God, this is like pets.com all over again? It's just a hyped bubble.
Yes and no. The more and more I dig in, the more and more I go no. Reading something the other day, I was like, oh, that Scott Galloway made a good point last newsletter, and that was just based on stocks and based on tech stocks and based on headcount, and just like a compelling argument for how some of the big seven are making like ridiculous like record profits and losing headcount is like, well, that's pretty hard to argue against. It's counterintuitive to what's happened in the past with company growth, and like made the point in that newsletter around the fact that, you know, brought into the fact that COVID was a bit of like a warfare around who could bring in talent, and then that's also shaved off, and that's fair enough. But then the continuing shaving of headcount and the continued growth is something that he put forward, saying that no one's actually saying what's going on there and how impactful AI is. And it definitely makes you think. And then this is a person who's lived through the dot-com era and had skin in the game and got absolutely burnt. And so he's wary of that naturally, but not to say you can't get burnt twice. The definition of dumb is there for a reason, but it's a compelling argument. So to answer your question, yeah, I do believe it is there. And I think on top of that, it's been coming for a while, like, feels like we're entering a new revolution. The Industrial Revolution brought us out of, predominantly out of sort of, you know, I don't even know the term for it, but it brought us into factories away. I don't know what it was like back then, but it definitely brought a lot of people from rural environments into urban environments, into factory, brought into the union idea, brought our idea and current understanding of what time is. You know, there was a universal time then, and the trains and everything like that, but it feels like now we're going into a new era, and it's definitely time to imagine great things, otherwise boring things happen. But it's also a really undefined time.
It's true. And it's, you know, I guess the kind of the long-term curve is away from labor. And what I mean by that is, if you look back to the 1800s, I mean, you know, you being out in Gippsland, you would have been, you know, trying to scrape a living from the land out there, and you would have been using maybe a horse to help you to kind of augment your labor. Now, when you look around Gippsland, they're using tractors to do that, you know, in terms of kind of, you know, that, but there's still someone in the seat. But when you look kind of further afield and you look into places like, you know, the Midwest of America, where, you know, everyone talks about automation in the sense of self-driving cars, but like self-driving tractors, that's a legit thing where you can just basically send them out and away they go, particularly in a world kind of faced by climate change, et cetera. It might be the only time you can do harvesting and things like that into the future. So this, you don't need as many people. That's the thing that comes out of all of that, is that to actually increase your results. And, you know, like, I mean, I love kind of, you know, Scott Galloway's kind of wry kind of take on everything, but I do feel like he misses a bigger point in all of this, which is that tip should be expected. That tip, in terms of kind of the tip away from labor, is how our economy is actually set up, and it's been happening forever. But the real question that no one actually gets to is, what do you do with all the surplus labor? What do you actually do with it? Do you have everyone sit and, you know, kind of basically, you know, meta themselves to death, which is just digging into a hole of kind of, you know, trying to entertain oneself with the idle hands? Or do you actually try to find ways to go, you know what, maybe in the future we're not going to need as many people in those things that we've kind of traditionally put them in? How do we actually ensure that there is meaning left for people? And that's kind of my point around a universal basic income, is maybe it's a way to, you know, reconstitute volunteerism, reconstitute these types of areas that really genuinely make a difference in people's lives. Like, rather than, you know, up in Ballarat, maybe rather than have, you know, 2,000 volunteers, you know, fighting a fire that's being paid broadly by their employers, maybe it should be that they actually get paid to be the volunteer, right? I mean, I think that's the thing that I do think is an interesting, we're in an interesting inflection point, that, because it's not just AI, is it? Like, what you're talking about there, it's actually about that coding is becoming more and more automated. So it takes less people, right? I was in a coffee roastery. We did this coffee tasting at work, which was really, really cool to kind of see how it was all made, et cetera. But I was really struck, they're still using like a big display screen to monitor the roast. And I was like, oh, in 4 years, these guys, it won't be all of them either. It'll probably be two of them. And they'll be strapped in, like they'll be wearing the factory, if that makes sense. Like, that's where I think we're kind of entering this age of the augmented person.
Yeah. And it's in, like, your point around the inevitability, it's there. We've been moving away from, you know, labor, or like what labor is, and we're going into a new phase of, and it seems undetermined what that is. I think critical thought, but my feeling on that is, and just, I don't know, needs to be probably backed up with more data, but the initial gut feeling is humanity has, and society and culture has, an innate ability to find things to do, whether for better or for worse. So that's an interesting point of yours, like idle hands. I don't think we'll ever get to that unless like the economy completely bottoms out in a lot of countries, which it could. But at the same time, when there's so much revenue being raked in, there's an obvious play that would have to go down at that point.
Yeah, well, I guess the economic bet is that it tips to leisure, right? So it tips to leisure time. So therefore, it's kind of, yeah, it's more of a, it's a continuation of the consumption economy, really.
Exactly. Which is,
you know, I mean, the amount of, you know, I mean,
pigs in pens, baby.
Yeah, the amount of caravans you see kind of rocking around Australia, you know, kind of, I mean, I think you made the point when we were together over the weekend. It's like, you know, it's like a $500,000 rig, right? And there's not one or two of those, there's 50 of them. And people are kind of dragging them around the country, like looking for what's next, right? So it's, you know, it's not just gray nomading anymore. It's kind of where they used to, you know, like we have back in North America, the snowbirds who just go and find warmth for the winter. It's not just that anymore. It's actually that they're actually looking for ways to kind of, you know, engage and experience life, but it's kind of based in leisure time. But I do think there becomes a crisis of human meaning after a while. And if that crisis comes earlier in life, I do worry about that, right? So it's kind of, but you could find meaning through like a universal basic income or UBI, where maybe that's your thing, right? Maybe it's kind of, you know, you do your bit, you kind of go, yeah, I'm getting this, but I know that I'm covered, so therefore I'm going to take my time and invest it in things I care about, rather than just consuming things that are put up there for kind of people who broadly are, you know, there's less and less, you know, the generational kind of wealth that's there with those people retiring at the moment. That's never going to be repeated at that same level, at that same scale. So it's a question of what comes next, right? What actually comes next in terms of when people, you know, maybe don't have as much to do, because I wouldn't want us to end up in the thing you see in like developing countries, where you have 30% of the male population under the age of 24 has no prospects, no jobs. That is not a cocktail for anything good happening.
No, and like those fears are so just, but at the same time, like my feel on that is that there's going to be jobs, and there's going to be like new ways of doing things, and it's going to be geared towards the young crew who are ready and able and willing to find those new opportunities. Like, that's such a throwaway comment to sort of like the Australian equivalent of "she'll be right," but it feels like,
yeah.
But it, like, I'd imagine there'd be similar conversations, not the same way doing, but when, you know, Henry Ford made the Ford factory, and like automated making cars, automated doing, you know, X, Y, and Z. There's so many new ways of involving human, what that is, I think. And at the same time, it is a really good opportunity to go, like, how should we spend our lives and what does that actually mean? Whether we will ever get to that is an interesting question in and of itself.
It's actually the security. It's the security piece, right? So, like, in the Ford factory, those workers found security, you know, after getting pummeled by the police, et cetera, in unionizing, so that they actually had a collective voice. Like, I'm no socialist by any means, but I think the thing that comes out of that is that, what's that construct in the modern world? Because I think what we are looking into is a world that is more insecure. So how do you allow, like, when people might have more of, like, you know, whatever, they like portfolio careers, you know, kind of constantly reskilling, etc. But how do you allow for that in a world where, you know, I think all I'm arguing for is, like, underpinning people with something that is certain, that allows them to step in and take a bit more risk in their lives, rather than being like, oh, geez. Like, I was even reading this thing the other day about in The Guardian, talking about how universities become drudgery, right, for this generation coming through, because they look at it as, I have to go there. It's a step to get that job over there, right? They don't look at it as
not. But that's what I'm sort of saying. It's changing. There's a lot of forward-thinking companies are not actually hiring and bringing down that barrier, going like, where is your real-world experience? What are you actually playing with? Where are you there? And what are you bringing in? What's your interest? But it's sort of breaking down those old barriers. And I don't want anyone listening into this saying Patty's against universal income. I'm just sort of, I'm saying, yeah, that'd be awesome. Let's do universal income. I think it, for better or worse, I think it would be a really good thing for people to have, and for it to sit there and for everyone to understand what that is, negotiate that at a community and at a national level, like what that actually is and how to distribute that. But I think the interesting part in this conversation is, like, where we are now and where is work and what is work and what does that actually mean? And I think it's happening like live time. Like, unis right now have never been more stale. Like, and that's happening. So speaking to Gary A. Bowles, who's existed in this space for a long time, his big take is, what's happened to media is happening right now to education as we speak. And it's called, like, he frames it as, you know, it's like going into education in bite size and then being able to go across the vertical. Because at the moment, you're talking about that tractor, you go to a agricultural workshop and they're like, yeah, you got to do this. But then at the same time, if you're really interested in the future of ag, then you've also got to get almost like an astronaut, or like a piece from like tech. You've got to get that tech understanding, and then got to get satellite understanding, and how do you get that unilateral across many verticals? And that's where we're sitting, and the current education system isn't set up for people to get a take on a lot of different things. And that's where, like, innovation comes, when you break open that and be able to give people who have interest in many things to be able to cross-pollinate across industries. And I feel like that's what AI is allowing us to do, just by the very way that it operates.
Yep.
But it allows us access to cherry pick that information that exists there without having to sit through 3-year course, where, to be honest, the innovation in education is being non-existent, and it's been absolutely buffered out by just people sitting there filling their pockets. Like, it's literally people just made, like, sorry, institutions have made a ridiculous amount of money by just holding degrees and saying, you shall pass, you shall not. And that's been their business model. And now that's up for grabs. And it's like, how does that go? How does that work? At the same time, it helps the economy. It's helped Australian economy ridiculously. But at the same time, we haven't put enough innovation into that. So where do we land there with Ed? It's like, well, where are we landing with media at the moment? That's a fascinating question, with lots of things coming out. But I think it's coming for a lot of industries. And it's like, well, maybe it is time to rethink what that actually looks like. And maybe that's for the better, but it's going to be freaking, it's going to be really hard. And that's your point. Maybe universal income will really soften that.
Something. Like I feel it'll make it. Yeah, I feel it'll make it easier for people to go through the transition. That's probably where I'm coming from on my end in that is that really I don't think fear leads to anything good ever in life. So if you're afraid of something and you're kind of looking down the barrel of something rather than actually being able to embrace it, that's where the problems begin. Just right there before you go any further. So, you know, if you take the analogy of journalism, you know, because the economic model really was underpinned by classified ads, etc., you know, and kind of that those things allowed then for people to write things that were interesting. So you kind of bought the paper for the classifieds, but you happen to read other things along the way. That's kind of that shift in journalism now, where it's actually that you as the journo always have to be thinking about revenue, kind of this model that allows you to actually be self-sustaining, becomes challenging, really, because it's about those who can do it, but then you're not necessarily getting the spread of I guess kind of, you know, opinion that you necessarily want to see. It becomes consolidated. But if that same journalist was underpinned by something and they could take a bit more risk, because really, like, I mean, I think the reason I started thinking about this was that not to do with AI, it's actually to do with the death of entrepreneurism, which is that there's never been less companies started than in the last 5 years, right? So people are going no, right, to that, which, you know, I find astounding in terms of kind of, you know, when we're spoken to continually about that's kind of really the engine of how we actually kind of create wealth in our world is through those types of bets being made by individuals, you know, how you bring a company together around you. But maybe it's too risky to take risk, right? That's the part that when you start to go and dig a little bit further into the tunnel, it does feel like that's the generation that's kind of gonna have to live through this, is that how do you manage those things? And then also, it's not just the young person with a road ahead of them, it's also that the, you know, what happens to the, you know, the 50-year-old Microsoft software engineer, right? What happens to him or her or they, like, what happens to them, right? What happens to them when Microsoft says no more?
Yeah, that's a really hard cohort, the 50, that area where it's like, where we are so ageist in the workforce, where it's like, oh, well, no point investing in you because you've already gone so far down the line that it's like, oh, sorry, we're going to invest in the young, the youth. They know what's going on. We have no idea. Let's just put our hands off the wheel and pay them less and just say, hey, you do it.
You find a new way. That stuff's under threat because, like, that knowledge, right? Like, I think that's the one of the most interesting things coming out of COVID is that those who were kind of, you know, basically the mass retirement, right? So that the actual kind of, like, really our labor, you know, it sounds crass in a way, but like our real employment rate is probably where it was ahead of COVID. It's just that a whole bunch of people retired, right? So, and you see that everywhere you go, right? It's like if you wander into you know, a cafe Tuesday afternoon, it's not everyone kind of sitting there like the Starbucks, you know, kind of parody of, you know, it's all kids kind of writing code. You know who it is? It's 50-plus-year-olds sitting around having a coffee after going for a bike ride, predominantly, right? So that's the, but they all,
that's Merrick's, that's the Merrick's reality, baby.
it's everywhere. It's not just, I mean, of course it's definitely, we're over indexed, we're on the forefront of that, but it's everywhere. And it was the great checkout of kind of that, you know, those who could did at that point in time, they just went, yeah, I'm done. And that is kind of what's underpinned our unemployment rate being so low. But that's not forever. It's that if those people now that stayed in the workforce then changes, that the employers themselves are going, well, they don't actually have the skill sets, right? They've got deep knowledge, expertise. They're not what you're talking about, which is that they are able to be multidisciplinary in terms of bringing these things together to create new value. They're not that. They literally know how to build, I don't know, software, but like Python or C++. That's them, right? That's their swim lane.
Yeah, and that swim lane's been obliterated. And that sucks to be, like, without sugarcoating that. That sucks to be in that position and to see, like, Navita CEO saying everyone can now write code. You if you can talk, you can write code. And then even then, Elon going so far to say, if you can think, put a cognitive, you know, sentence or thought in your mind, you can write code, which is great because it breaks down the barrier of that once again. And there are barriers being broken. And then that's really hard for people who have put their life and energy, their life's like work energy into that, to be able to service whatever they were building. That's hard. That's like a really hard moment for them. But I will say something.
The shit of it is, though, is that you know, if you can talk, and also like the caveat in that question, and pay $40 USD a month, you can write code, right? That's the piece that they don't fill in that sentence.
Yeah, the blank. Whether that'll come down or not, who knows? But at the moment, yeah, there's definitely a cash barrier to that. Whether it'll increase, we'll see. But there's a few pieces in that. I feel like entrepreneurship was actually massive. I think there was never bigger uptake during COVID. And now because the cost of capital is so high, that's just that was like by design to kill bad businesses, whatever that means. It also probably killed a lot of young businesses that had ambition but didn't have the capital. They're casualties in that policy. Whether that'll change and whether people will be able to uptake that. I also think risk-taking is not necessarily thumbed up in society, like culturally. There's a lot of bubble wrapping going on, not just from the Amazon warehouse. And there needs to be a little bit of a take on that, like what is. And everyone talks about grit. Everyone talks about being able to push through the hard stuff, but I don't think it's taught, and I don't think it's spoken about very well, because everyone's, you know, we're perpetually afraid. But how do we lean into being afraid is an interesting question, and when is that healthy, and what are the limits on that?
Definitely.
I think that's where we're at, like, and how to build that. But the other piece that comes off that is the Microsoft CEO said today, Sam Altman's clever, but we've got to invest in other AI, and that's sort of signaling that there's a new up and coming class that'll challenge the Titans, and rightfully so, because they're hugely valued. And then there's also like, this will automate a lot of the tasks across, and then there'll be new services and new products that'll have to come to be able to forbear that, and the cycle continues, which is like for better or for worse. But that just feels like the rollout of this, and that signaling is an interesting one. You know, where does innovation creep out from underneath the carpet of corporate talk? I think that's going to happen, and it's going to happen in strange and beautiful ways. But it's definitely going to be hard for a cohort, and universal income, or for many cohorts, universal income would go a long way, you'd think, or at least that conversation, and hopefully bring, you know, the class chatter down a little bit, and hopefully bring people together. And I love your take on volunteerism. We've spoken about this on the podcast so often, that the town square has been corroded, and that people don't really look at each other in the eye, but you definitely do around disaster, and there's more disaster coming, and there's more need for people to pick up. And maybe the manual labor is that volunteerism when things turn.
Yeah, totally, shit. Totally. Because I think like the problem statement is, you know, to me, that I think about a lot, in like a world where more and more of the spoils go to capital, how do you make sure that kind of those who labor, or the value of labor, isn't corroded in all of that, right? Because that's the real risk that's in society, and it is becoming more and more unjust by the day, right? So for every NVIDIA, you can basically say, well, here's another 3,000 people who are doing it tough, not able to actually afford their electricity bill this month. And they're actually correlated, right? Because obviously for every chip that NVIDIA sells, the thing that no one talks about is the amount of electricity those bloody things use, right? So there is a correlation that you can actually draw. And that's the part of the world where I think, you know, I hope that kind of government can actually have a really strong think about kind of how we change some of these things around us to make sure that, you know, the kind of that labor and kind of, you know, and what I mean by that is really just actually putting effort into something rather than just putting financial means into something, right? Of course, that's kind of how you get the capital that's how everyone gets it, but it's kind of disproportionately those capital is running away from labor. And in kind of more balanced societies, those things are a little bit more balanced, but it feels like a policy framework that is absolutely missing at the moment, which is that it's, you know, like we've just gone through it here in Australia, right? I mean, they had a chance to start to change our tax base. They didn't take it. And there's other things that, unless we get under the hood of that a little bit more and start to think about kind of how we really protect the kind of the idea of worker is rather than kind of investor, that is a thing that we really, really need to focus on, I feel.
Valid points, valid points. It's outrageous how many more points capital gets versus labor. And it definitely corrodes the idea of what's hanging onto the cliff of what it means to be Australian around that working idea. Valid points. And I think it'll be the challenge is how to best do that. And that's where we are at the moment. And it takes brave government. And I think we spoke about this off air on our weekend. It's like, you know, it takes a brave government, not just, we were talking about Trudeau, he's done nothing really, arguably, over in the Canada, except try and hang on to power. But like, maybe it's actually take that window and try and make some change versus just hold on and make a brave move. And that's arguably what happened here. It's easy to sit on the sofa and say that's what to do, but at the same time, that's sort of, we've painted a pretty vivid picture of where things are. You'd hope the awareness is there. I think everyone's saying cost of living, but what actions are going into that is debatable.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah. So on that riveting note, Joey.
Yeah, done.
Baby.
Yeah, let's buckle up for a day where it's gonna, you know, touch 40 degrees here in Australia, and kind of fingers crossed for those kind of that are gonna be affected by by the fires today.
Yeah. But one other thing that I would say is, I think on your note was shared value, and I think that's something that can tie into our previous conversation, and that is, you know, base income would be great, but then it's like, where's collective, if it's still saying capital wins, and it's like, where's collective capital going, and what can, out of this new transition, what can be pulled together and sort of trump that? Super in Australia's huge amount of cash, but what does that look like for government? What does that look like, you know, to be able to distribute that back and give not even share, but a bit more of a share than what we have now, and harness a little bit of that sort of community spirit? Like, what does that look like?
But those are the big, you're touching on kind of like major policy reforms around, like, really what you'd be saying in that construct is like a pension is pulled forward so that it basically runs through everyone's life. That's what the state does. But then kind of, you know, super and kind of like that commitment to that out of your kind of wages, etc., in older age is the kind of stuff that's what the super system is there to do, right? So there's lots of different ways that you know, you can allow people to participate in basically, you accept that you live in a more capitalistic society, right? That's actually what I'm arguing for, is you accept that and you do something about it. So rather than taxing, you know, people's labor, you start to tax capital in a more effective way. And of course, then a lot of the pushback becomes, well, capital is borderless, it can move anywhere, etc. That's true, except for super, right? And other things like that, which is that, you know, like, we are an incredibly lucky country here in Oz. Like, we sit on what I think is the fifth or sixth biggest pile of money in the world, right? That is now only compounding through our exposure to it. So our future selves are very, very happy that NVIDIA stock is doing as well as it can, because we all have exposure to that through our super funds, right? That our banks do well, that our grocery kind of retailers do well, that anyone does well. But the thing is that our current selves at the moment, and kind of like future people coming into the workforce, it's that, how do you allow them to do that without fear, right? And that's the thing that I think is drives me a bit nuts with baby boomers, to be honest. Like, when you have a conversation with them, they're just like, oh, yeah, you know, it's like, well, I've worked for it all. And it's like, yeah, you have, but you did it without fear, right? You were actually given a platform to stand on, whereas kind of today's generation actually have to build their own platform, right? They actually have to dig themselves and go, here I am, right? And they start earlier. So therefore, perhaps things are a little bit less expansive and a little bit less settled for them. And I think that's just a big societal rift that I do really worry about is that it's not just that those who have and those who have not. It's that in a financial sense, it's actually in a chance to take a risk without fear of the consequence sense.
Yeah, that platforming, that's creating that environment where you're not scared of, you know, fires, winds, whether they be of climate or of financial hardship is valid, mate. I think we can go somewhere next week, hopefully bring some heat in a good way. But until then, as always, Joey, it's nice to chew the fat with you.
Same, mate. Same. And yeah, enjoy the day out in beautiful Gippsland. And yeah, that's we'll chat next week.